And welcome to LNL on what is going to be a busy night. You'll recall, dear listeners, that the Nigerian elections were meant to be held in February. They were postponed because the government couldn't fight Boko Haram. At the same time, securing voters at electoral booths. Well, since then, they've had the elections, and President Goodluck Jonathan has lost his big gamble. Sarah Chaser returns to the program shortly to tell us why he lost. And you may be interested to know that Myanmar's army has launched a deadly offensive in the country's north. It's displaced thousands in the region of Kukang and is committing oodles of human rights abuses. A fascinating story, and Paul Mooney will be joining us to discuss that. When I started doing Late Night Live 25 years ago, I think, I took to calling it LNL for the simple reason that the audience for the repeat on the following day was rather larger than the audience at night. So, LNL it was, and ever since then I've been playing with it, with that, and making little adjustments to it to amuse myself. Most frequently, of course, it becomes Lennon L to demonstrate our infamous bias. On this occasion, the program will be called Ale and Ill, or Ill and Ale, because tonight we will be looking at the misnamed wellness industry, which is a place of frauds, fools and fanatics. And the wellness industry, as you will learn, has a bad habit of killing people. Okay, President Goodluck Jonathan lost the gamble, and 60 million registered voters made history as the opposition leader defeated the incumbent for the first time in Nigeria's history. Now, the new boss, or the president-elect Buhari, said he would give rapid attention to stopping the violence in northeastern Nigeria, where Boko Haram operates, and also promises to plug the corruption holes in the country. Sarah Chase, former advisor to the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, senior associate at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, and Sarah's latest is called Thieves of State: Why Corruption Threatens Global Security. And she joins us from her home in Washington. Sarah, welcome back.
Thanks for having me again.
Jonathan deserves full credit for allowing the reform of Nigeria's electoral processes, even if it led to his defeat. Tell us how forensic this reform was.
It was quite significant, and I would say I'm not convinced that he did this willingly. I think there was quite significant international pressure and sort of watching the whole process. You had quite remarkable joint, for example, statements by the UK Foreign Secretary and the US Secretary of State. You had President Obama himself weighing in, and other world leaders. I think there was a remarkable degree of international, I would say, consensus that this election had to be, it couldn't be a preposterous theft the way many people were afraid that it might be. And so indeed, Jonathan can be credited for listening and for taking account of those international views. In particular, the head of the Independent Election Commission was widely seen to be both professional and independent, and that made a big difference.
This is Professor Jager.
That's correct. Although he did come under tremendous pressure, as you mentioned in your lead-up, to postpone this election. And that pressure came from the security agencies, meaning the army, state security, the police, who kind of pulled him in just prior to when the election was supposed to have been held, and presented him with what many might see as almost an organized crime-type veiled threat, which is, if you go ahead with this election, we can't guarantee its security. Well, you know, when the mafia says stuff like that, that's understood in a certain way. And so that was the one example of very clear meddling with the electoral process. The pretext given was, as you mentioned, the Boko Haram insurgency in the Northeast. But most Nigerians said, hey, you know, what are you talking about? For 6 years, you haven't been addressing this insurgency, and suddenly in 6 weeks, you're going to turn it around. I mean, it was quite transparently a political gambit to try to regain lost ground in the campaign that was dressed up as a security concern.
Yet one has to salute Jacob, because he spends years studying the rigging methods, and he implements an elaborate system of voter registration. He trained thousands of electoral staff and introduced biometric readers. What were they, please, Sarah?
Well, right. I mean, let me just finish by agreeing with you. Jega was subjected to this unbelievable pressure to delay the election. He almost couldn't do otherwise. But that's what it took. It took every security agency in the country essentially threatening that the election would be incredibly bloody if he didn't delay it. But otherwise, he did really a terrific, I think, I mean, widely recognized as a significant job. The card readers, biometric card readers, were aimed at ensuring that every ballot that was counted did in fact correspond to an individual person who had submitted biometric, you know, data, including fingerprints and things like that. You had American officials saying, golly, maybe we need this system in the United States, you know. The point was, everyone had a permanent voter card with that biometric data registered into it. And then before casting their ballot, they had to be accredited at their polling station by having these cards read. Now, as you can imagine, in a differentially developed country in West Africa, that process went forth differentially, let's just put it that way, in different places. It was difficult in some places for the cards to be read, and so a number of polling stations had to be kept open for a second day of voting. What was even more inconvenient generally was that this process was a two-stage process. So you had to go in the morning, get your card read, and then come back again in the afternoon to actually vote. I can't imagine many Americans or potentially Australians who would subject themselves to that much discomfort. But when I spoke to people on, you know, who were waiting online on the phone, they were saying, if I have to stand here for a year, I am going to cast my vote. The sense of determination that you heard from Nigerian voters to cast their votes and have their votes be counted was really remarkable. And that was in the face of this inconvenience, which was compounded by the fact that many polling stations didn't open until several hours after they were supposed to. So the hour for getting your little card accredited was supposed to start, or the period was supposed to start at 8 a.m., whereas often, you know, and therefore voters started lining up at 6 a.m., but often the workers didn't show up until 9:30 or 10. And so people really submitted to this kind of inconvenience almost as though they wanted to overwhelm any potential rigging effort by their sheer numbers.
Aylin Ill, or Ilan Ail, on RN, and my guest is Sarah Chase, and we're discussing the Nigerian elections. Okay, thumbs up to the thumbprint. Sarah, you've reported that Goodluck Jonathan spent as much as $56 million to rent campaign supporters.
This has been an administration that's been characterized by just off the charts corruption in a country that in some ways has become almost synonymous with corruption. The Goodluck Jonathan administration has topped it all. And that's one example. The amount of money that has been spent on, you know, either efforts to rig, on gathering, gathering so-called supporters to rallies, on, trying to pay local leaders to swing people who may be loyal to them in the direction of the ruling party. I mean, anything you can imagine. But that's just, I think, one of the uses to which pillaged national funds have gone. So one of the most extraordinary of a string of scandals that have come to light in recent months has been, and which was very much a topic of debate during the campaign, was the approximately $20 billion U.S. dollars that went missing from the oil revenues over an 18-month period from the beginning of 2012 until mid-2013, with apparently no remedial, you know, actions taken since then, so it could be double as much by now. And this was made public by the then governor of the central bank, who was fired for having made this public. And the government claimed that it was going to order an audit. It did order an audit, although that audit was so constrained that the findings couldn't really correspond to the allegations that were made. The audit was never made public until there was so much pressure during the campaign that the government felt obligated to make some snippets of it public, but still never published the entire audit. And I think that, together with delaying the election, it really was just so flagrant, the effort, number one, the pillaging that's been going on at the highest reaches of the Nigerian government, and secondly, the desperate effort to remain in power in order either to continue pillaging or at least to protect themselves from any repercussions for what they had already done. That also, I think, helped push the electorate in the direction of the opposition.
Now, you've pointed out that Nigeria, that the election involved a sort of perfect storm, which included the shock of collapsing oil prices, and the United States has actually, of course, stopped buying oil. You argue that the US is now in a great position to push for sanctions against corruption instead of pledging money for counterterrorism support.
Indeed, and I actually think the two issues which have been the most important issues dominating this campaign, that is to say corruption and, of course, the Boko Haram insurgency in the northeast of the country, are related. I've spent, you know, the last 5 years studying the correlations between acute government corruption and the explosion of militant Islamist movements, not just in Nigeria or in Afghanistan, where I spent a decade, but the same logic applies to the expansion of ISIS in Syria and Iraq, and extremist movements across North Africa and even in Central Asia. And it's quite interesting. And I have to say, even in, you know, sort of Anglo-American or Northern European and American history, there is a tendency among human beings when confronted by just off-the-charts lapses in public integrity to turn toward militant puritanical religion. I mean, without taking us too far down the history path, I'd like to suggest that we just think again about, for example, the Protestant Reformation and the quite bloody revolution that it, you know, revolution across Europe that it led to, in light of the very acute kleptocratic practices of the Catholic Church and a lot of the divine right monarchies in that
period. And of course, the mass sale of indulgences, these forms of corruption.
Precisely. And so all I'm trying to say is that this reflex to turn toward a puritanical and militant religious response in light of that type of corruption it's not just an Islam thing, and it's not just, you know, a 21st century thing. It is something that has recurred in, you know, the last number of centuries of human history. So what I'm trying to say is that Boko Haram initially was in part one of these violent extremist religious reactions to the very corruption that has, you know, been accelerating within the Nigerian government over the past decade. And so in some ways, what I'm suggesting is that one of the best ways to get at that insurgency is to reduce the underlying drivers of it, which is the corruption of the Nigerian government. And so now that you do have someone who seems to be, both by what he says and by his past record, a reformer, if even perhaps a somewhat draconian reformer, that it does seem to be an opportunity for the United States to support any efforts that he might make by, being willing to sanction individual Nigerian officials who are known to have absconded with a lot of money. And as you pointed out before, the fact that United States refineries are no longer purchasing Nigerian oil does mean that the political trade-offs for that type of effort are much less significant than they might have been a year or two ago. In other words, you don't have to worry about the oil supply today with abundant supply. In particular, in fact, U.S. oil in its quality is very, very similar to Nigerian oil. So if anything, Nigerian oil competes with U.S. oil. It doesn't, it's not a complementary product. And so it really won't be any skin off the U.S. back economically to take somewhat more rigorous measures against Nigerian kleptocrats than it has in the past.
I've only got a moment left with you, Sarah, but very quickly, do you think the generals, those millionaire generals, will take this lying down?
That's a great question. It's both the generals, but it's also the whole political elite that was just gorging itself at the trough. And one of the challenges that there are two challenges Buhari will face. One is that he had to bring a lot of former ruling party people into his coalition in order to win this election. So the question will be, how free will his hands really be to take some of the disciplinary measures that he might want to? And secondly, can he do that in an even-handed enough way that people who might have supported the Jonathan government won't feel that he's got a witch hunt going on?
Sarah, thank you very much. Sarah Chase, Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, author, Thieves of State, Why Corruption Threatens Global Security. And now off to Myanmar and Paul Mooney. Well, beloved listeners, you may be surprised to hear that just last month, Myanmar reportedly dropped a bomb on Chinese territory, killing 5 civilians and, not surprisingly, straining relationships. Now, that stray bomb reportedly came from Myanmar's Air Force, which has been conducting an offensive against armed groups along the Chinese border for the past couple of months. The operation has claimed over 100 lives, seen claims of human rights abuses, and displaced a reported 50,000 ethnic Chinese civilians from the region of Kokang. But the Kokang people aren't the only minority group getting hit hard by the government. It also recently banned so-called non-citizens, including an estimated 1.1 million Rohingya Muslims from voting in this year's elections. Now, there was some hope in recent years that the country might begin transitioning into something vaguely remembering or resembling a democracy, but with its military seemingly running wild and the government disenfranchising voters, undertones of the country's authoritarian past are beginning to resurface. Now, as a tour guide, to get us through this complicated story. I'm delighted to be joined now by Paul Mooney. Paul and I last spoke when he was in China. He was a very good correspondent, but for some reason, presumably his recalcitrance on human rights issues, his visa was not reviewed or renewed by the Chinese. Now he's a freelance journalist based in Myanmar. He spent the past 29 years reporting from China for a variety of outlets, including Reuters, South China Morning Post, Far Eastern Economic Review. And this well-credentialed fellow joins us now on The Blower from Bangkok. Welcome back to Late Night Live, Paul.
Yeah, thank you, Phil.
The program's looked at many different sectarian groups and persecuted minorities throughout Asia, but I must admit the Kokang people are making their first appearance on LNL. Many listeners probably never heard of them, yet they're at the centre of a conflict that could have regional ramifications. Tell us about them.
Well, the Kokang people, that area is along the border with Yunnan province in China. They're essentially Chinese people, but who emigrated hundreds of years ago across the border into Burma. So it's basically an ethnic Chinese group living in Myanmar's territory.
Now, it retains a special place in China's psyche, I understand.
This sympathy, I think, within China, for the people, because they're all ethnic Chinese. But the Chinese government has strongly denied that they've been involved in providing any support to the Kokang rebels who started launching attacks in this past February 9th.
I understand that it was a part of China for several centuries until it was ceded to Britain in 1897.
That's correct.
So it seems like this particular conflict on China's doorstep, nonetheless, broke out overnight. What sparked it?
Well, the Kokang had their own army. It was kind of a warlord army. They were involved in drug trade, and this was where the Communist Party of Burma was. And the Kokang army now was splintered off from the Communist Party of Burma in 1989, and then kind of had a loose relationship with the Burmese government up until 2009, when the Myanmar army came in and cracked down, and these rebels were sent into hiding, and so they'd been gone for the past 6 years or so, and just came back on February 9th when they launched attacks on several Myanmar army positions.
Paul, what are they after, the independence? What do they want?
Well, I guess it's a couple of things. One is, they're trying to win back control of that area. There's a lot of drugs in the area, a lot of trade across the border with China, and so they're trying to take back the control of that area.
Now, protecting its citizens abroad has been a key issue for the Chinese government. Why has Beijing's response to the deaths of Chinese nationals on its territory been so restrained?
Well, they have demanded apology. You're talking about the bombing, MiG bombing.
Yeah.
Yes. They have actually called for an apology and compensation, and they issued a stern warning to the Myanmar government and said that they would defend the territory. And they've even launched some military operations in the border area. The Myanmar government has vehemently denied that it actually bombed that area. They said they had nothing to do with that.
But some members of that government have claimed that Beijing is arming, training, and financing Kokang fighters.
Right. Myanmar officials and military and government, they've hinted at that, and they've actually won a lot of support from Burmese citizens by implying that this is some kind of infringement on Burma's territorial integrity. So they've gained a lot from this. But they haven't outright come out and accused China.
LNL on RN, and we're discussing conflict in Myanmar with Asia-based freelancer Paul Mooney. Myanmar's government is nearing the end of peace negotiations with more than a dozen ethnic groups. Why have the Kokang leaders been excluded from these talks, Paul?
I think it's because they'd pushed this Kokang group out of the area in 2009, and they don't recognize them or have not recognized them as being one of these one of the ethnic groups that they're negotiating with. I think there's a list of 16 different groups, so they're not willing to negotiate with them because they don't recognize them in that area.
Myanmar goes to the polls in October and November, don't they, Paul?
Yes, they do. Yes.
Does this year's election look like it will be more transparent and inclusive than the one held in 2010?
There's a lot more attention focused on it. A lot of international groups are coming in to monitor the election. We, you know, everyone's hoping that will be the case. But there are concerns about the election, and some people are starting to hint now that the election may actually not take place.
Really?
Right, and it could be the issue in Kokang, or it could be in the northwest where the Rohingya Muslims are. If some incident breaks out, the logic is that the government will use this as an excuse to postpone the elections. And it seems fairly certain that the ruling party that's dominated by the military will not win the election this time. That the NLD and the ethnic groups will have a majority in the parliament, and that the military is not ready to accept that. So there are fears now, and there are growing fears that the government may come up with an excuse, say that there's kind of fighting somewhere, trouble somewhere, and use that as an excuse to postpone the elections.
Now, Aung San Suu Kyi is prohibited from running for the presidency under the current constitution. Will she be able to run for the presidency?
No, she can't. The constitution forbids anyone from running if they have relatives who are foreign citizens, and her late husband was British, and her two sons have foreign citizenship, so that precludes her from running for president.
Well, I raise that because there's an upcoming constitutional referendum in May, which might pave the way.
Yeah, I really don't think that there will be a change in the constitution. The government has, the ruling party has no reason to change it, because it would only hurt them. If Aung San Suu Kyi runs for president, there's no doubt that she'll get elected. And I think there's really no possibility that they'll actually change the constitution before the next election.
Now, her National League for Democracy party expelled over 20,000 members of its own members last month. Why did they do that?
The NLD is now saying that it's actually 8,000, so the number's in dispute. But these were mainly Rohingya Muslims from the northwest. There's strong anti-Muslim feelings here among the Buddhist majority, and the parliament passed a rule in February saying that white card holders could not be members of political parties. In 1982, the Rohingyas lost their citizenship. And we're given these temporary white cards as a kind of an identification. In the past, they've been allowed to vote in elections, but this year the government's saying that they cannot be members of political parties. They're basically trying to disenfranchise the Rohingya Muslims.
So the NLD was forced to expel them, but I understand the party says that they will help the people they expelled gain citizenship.
Yeah, I don't think it's that easy. The government's been talking about new citizen verification, but the whole process is a bit vague. And actually, the NLD and Aung San Suu Kyi, they've been very careful not to even speak out on behalf of the Rohingyas. They're severely persecuted population, and Aung San Suu Kyi has never said one word in their defense. The NLD has not said anything in their defense. It would be political suicide for Aung San Suu Kyi and her party to say anything, because it would anger the Buddhist majority.
So even the Nobel laureate is self-censoring. Now, how can they live? How can the Rohingya, or indeed the Kokang, reside in Myanmar for years, for generations, and still yet not be considered citizens?
That's right. The Rohingya, the Rohingyas did have, the Kokang people have citizenship. The Rohingyas did have citizenship up until 1982. Since then, the government's tried to imply that they're illegal immigrants, that they've come over in recent years from Bangladesh. But the fact is that many of them lived there for decades, if not centuries, within Myanmar. It's with the Rohingyas, it's just an anti-Muslim, kind of a sentiment that's behind this.
What's the media scene in Myanmar, please, Paul? Is there an energetic and to some extent outspoken media?
Yeah, things have changed dramatically. You know, the government launched reforms in 2011, 2012. The media's opened up. It's incredible what they're allowed to report. If you look at the local Burmese media, Myanmar media, they're reporting issues. They're quite critical of the government, the ruling party. Sometimes they criticize the military. At the same time, over the past 15 months or so, about 18 or 19 journalists have been arrested and sent to prison. We had four journalists sent to jail for 10 years last year at hard labor. For trying to do some reporting on a military installation. On the one hand, it's much more open. There's a bit of a contradiction. At the same time, every month we're hearing about one or two journalists who get arrested.
What about so-called citizen journalists? What about social media?
It's very strong here. Facebook seems to be the main form of the citizen journalism. So there's a lot of discussion on Facebook by people. It's quite active there.
Okay, a final question is a personal one to you. Are you allowed back in China even as a visitor?
The Chinese government didn't say when I'd be allowed back in. In the past, when people have been refused visas or been kicked out, they've not been allowed back in for 3 to 5 years. I have a feeling I may never be allowed back in.
Okay, Paul, good to talk to you. Paul Mooney, Asia-based freelance journalist these days, who's reported from that part of the world for Reuters, for Newsweek, South China Morning Post, over the past 29 years, and on one previous occasion for the Little Wireless program. Next on Ill and Ale, or if you prefer, Ale and Ill, how the wellness wackos kill the gullible. I've been fascinated and repelled by the so-called wellness industry as long as I can remember. And as I recall, it, for practical purposes, it began in the early 1900s in Battle Creek, Michigan, when the Kellogg brothers and other ratbags invented the cornflake and started to transform the American diet. And along with that came all sorts of theories about how you destroy disease. There was a very good little film called The Road to Wellness, which was based on a book of the same name. You might in fact have read one or seen the other. But two recent news stories, the exposure of Belle Gibson, author of the cookbook The Whole Pantry, and the death of wellness warrior Jess Ainscough, have cast a spotlight on the wellness industry. People who shun conventional medicine in favour of meditation, fresh juices, coffee enemas. I like coffee, but there are better ways to ingest it. How much credibility does this have, and why are so many people willing to take the word of unqualified experts? Richard Gilliatt, feature writer with the Weekend Australian magazine, and Richard was just reminding me that we have an ancient history. We go back to the 1970s together, and for the past 2 years he's been investigating the phenomenon of wellness therapies. And he's sitting here in the studio looking remarkably healthy to tell us what he's found. Are you a better, healthier person as a result of your researches, Richard?
I think I'm a more disillusioned person.
Oh, well, I'm sad to hear it. Okay, let's define. What is the wellness industry? How big is it and where is it?
Well, the modern wellness industry really came as an outcrop of the early 70s alternative health movement. And the idea is essentially that health is a holistic thing, that you have to look at mind, body, spirit and environment to be truly healthy, which is a perfectly reasonable proposition. But the fringes of this movement developed deep hostility to Western conventional medicine, particularly as it's practiced with cancer. And so you had a viewpoint that chemotherapy and radiotherapy or poisoning and burning, as they're often referred to in the wellness industry, were not only counterproductive, but were actually a sort of profit-making device of drug companies and the Western medical system.
We're hearing much the same sort of arguments by people opposing vaccination programs at the moment, aren't we?
There, indeed, there's a very similar line of argument. And those sorts of arguments were on the fringes of this movement until the advent of social media, particularly over the last 5 to 10 years, when they migrated into the mainstream via a lot of bloggers. And in Australia, we've had a succession of bloggers. Jess Ainscoe, who you mentioned, was one, who is a young woman who developed a very rare form of sarcoma and announced on her blog that she was foregoing any conventional treatment. I should add that she did have a conventional chemotherapy treatment which didn't work, and at that point she announced that she was foregoing any further conventional treatment and declining the suggestion that she have her arm amputated, which was the only treatment they could really offer at that point, and was going to undertake what's called Gerson therapy, which was devised in the 1930s by an expatriate German doctor.
In fact, his full name, Dr. Max Gerson. Tell me about Gerson.
Well, Gerson was a physician in Germany, and he came up with a theory that detoxification was the key to, in fact, fighting all sorts of illnesses. And he developed a regime of coffee enemas, which he believed expunged toxins from the body. And he developed what could only be seen as a very rigorous regime, which involved 5 of these enemas a day, along with up to 13 organic juices and a completely vegetarian diet.
One of his local acolytes is a fellow I know and quite like, an Ian Gawler, well-intentioned fellow, but he was pushing this very hard some years ago.
Ian Gawler did use the Gerson method when he had what were believed at that time to be secondary cancers, and he did have a remarkable remission. Gawler had these bony growths in his chest, which were seen to be secondary cancers. There is now some debate about whether that in fact is true.
So some of the apparent miracles may be misdiagnosis if they're not out-and-out fraud.
Look, I think in the Gawler case, there's an argument there about whether he did have cancer or whether it was tuberculosis. But certainly what's true about Gawler is that he was a major promoter of Gerson-type approaches, as well as other things such as meditation. And in fact, he very strongly influenced Jess Ainscoe, the young woman from Queensland, who visited him and adopted the Gerson therapy.
You're talking about Ian in the past tense. Is he no longer with us?
No, he is with us.
Oh, okay. I hadn't heard that he died.
I was using the past tense in the sense of what he espoused at that time.
Okay. So much of what Gerson advised goes back to the 30s, and emphasis on healthy diet, holistic healing, as you say. So I'd concede that there's some merit to the holistic argument. What concerns you, though, is that people turn their backs on conventional medicine and often condemn themselves to death.
It's not just adopting alternatives as a complement to Western medicine. In the case of Jess Ainscoe, she, for instance, on her blog, said that Western medicine in its approach to cancer was a scam and that it should be avoided. You shouldn't have biopsies. And she announced, in fact, about 18 months into her Gerson therapy, that she had cured herself. And that was the basis for the remarkable following she developed online, which, she has said that she had 2.5 million visitors to her website by about 2013. So the thing that was the phenomenon of social media allowed people like her from a room in on the Sunshine Coast to reach 2.5 million people around the world.
LNL on Radio National, RN, rather, and my guest is Richard Gilliatt, and we're discussing the wellness industry. Now, the people, wellness advocates, accuse the medical profession of downplaying, suppressing, misrepresenting their success rate. But as you point out, quite a lot of people in the wellness industry obfuscate their own problems.
That was the thing about this whole phenomenon that really concerned me. For instance, Jess Ains Co did announce, in fact, that she was cured and attracted a lot of people to her website who were quite explicit about the fact that they were going down the same path as her, inspired by her. And in fact, when her mother got breast cancer, her mother Sharon also announced on the blog that she was foregoing medical treatment. The fact of the matter is, as we now know, because Jess Ains Co died about a month ago, that she was not cured. But not only that, towards the end of her life, when her cancer did in fact come back very aggressively, she denied ever saying that she'd been cured and attempted to sort of rewrite the history of her own blog.
It's also true that many people in this category forget to mention that they had conventional treatment at some point. They brush that aside.
Well, one of the things that is very difficult about this area is that you invariably never hear from these people's doctors. What you get is an account of their illness and their treatment, which is from them. And certainly Jess Ains Co and her family, now that she has died, are saying that Western medicine had nothing to offer her, that amputation of her arm was only ever going to be an experimental procedure. But we don't know whether that's true. And what we do know is that certain conventional procedures were tried with her. Unfortunately, they didn't work.
I don't get too angry or upset if people have conventional treatment plus. But I get very angry when the unconventional treatment kills them. And I'm thinking of a phenomenon that you didn't cover because it really passed, peaked and passed, and that was the so-called psychic surgery phenomenon in the Philippines, which had branch offices here with a bit of conjuring. People were persuaded that a cancer had been removed almost magically from the body, which had no sign of a surgical procedure. I remember the BBC making a film which showed a complete jumbo jet full of people going for psychic surgery in the Philippines, and they ran it a year later, and as they came out of the plane, they froze the image on every passenger, dead, 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 because they'd foregone treatment that would almost certainly have saved them.
Look, that is the issue that I wanted to investigated in these articles, is that people are, one of the features of a lot of the more extreme wellness blogs is the notion that there are very simple cures for cancer, such as eating raw food or having 5 coffee enemas a day, and or going on some other exclusionary diet of some kind, and that these are somehow, you know, the knowledge of them is kept away from you by the corrupt medical establishment. And there is no check and balance on these claims. There's, in fact, seems to be no law against making these claims.
There seems to be two distinct categories, perhaps three. The deluded, the shonky, yes, and the third category, the absolutely well-intended. It gets a bit tricky for you to separate them out, I would think.
There are gradations, I think, of misleading behaviour in this field, and when I stumbled across the Bell Gibson story more recently, that's when I realised that this area had become really corrupted, because Bell Gibson was a young woman based in Melbourne who claimed that she'd been given 4 months to live because of an inoperable brain tumour in 2009. And furthermore had begun a blog and a business promoting her health regime. And by last year, she was claiming that she had, in fact, 5 types of cancer more or less announced her impending death online. She had 200,000 followers on Instagram and a pretty successful business. She had a deal with Apple to create an app for its devices, and she had international publishing deals. And I just took one look at her story, and I just found it very difficult to see how anybody could have survived in that way.
Norman Swan, my distinguished medical colleague here at Radio National, makes the point, if it sounds too good to be true, it's often simply not true.
It's a good point, but it's a point that so many people in the media just fail to heed. I mean, Bel Gibson appeared in numerous media outlets, in at least four or five glossy women's magazines. She published a book last year, which Penguin distributed, in which she repeated her cancer claims. It now appears that they're almost certainly completely fabricated. I mean, I tracked down people who knew her when she was 14 and recalled her saying she had cancer at high school back then.
Okay, if a lot of the media have been culpable, gullible, stupid, it has to be said that you've been given quite a lot of time to research this, so we should talk about your media affiliation. You've been writing this stuff over some time now for the Weekend Australian magazine, so there's still the odd place in journalism where you're given time and space.
Well, indeed, and that's a shrinking luxury, unfortunately. But in the case of that original story I wrote in 2012 about Jess Ainsco, that was a piece that I researched for weeks and weeks. And the more recent stories on Bel Gibson required about a month's investigative work because I didn't know what was wrong with this woman, whether she had, you know, it's very difficult to sort of prove a negative, if you like, to prove that she did not have a brain tumour or to have cancer.
And also, wouldn't there be the risk of your target being litigious?
Well, more than that, I mean, there certainly was that risk. There was the risk that she didn't have quite what she said she had, but maybe she had health issues, and that if we suggested there was nothing wrong with her at all, that we would be open to litigation. But more than that, there was a risk. There was an issue also about what her reaction to being exposed might be, because when I interviewed her, I got the sense that she was quite a psychologically fragile person, and she wept a number of times during the interview, and so that was another issue.
Okay, Dr. Caligari comes to mind as I raise the issue of Dr. Sartori. Tell us about Dr. Sartori.
Dr. Sartori was, again, a German-born physician who seems to have had similar ideas to Dr. Gerson, in the sense that you cure cancer by ridding the body of toxins. He had a different technique, which was to administer all sorts of strange substances to his patients. He also advocated enemas. And one of the things about these more recent alternative health treatments is the extremeness of them. Doctors that I interviewed spoke about this, that they're seeing people who are putting themselves through very extreme types of therapy. In the case of Dr. Sartori, he had a dozen people in a clinic in Perth giving themselves enemas, being administered cesium chloride, and also an industrial solvent for all different types of cancer, and all 12 of those people died in circumstances which were extremely distressing for their families.
Okay, tell us about Genevieve Bond.
Gemma Bond.
Gemma.
She is one of several Australian bloggers, in this case a mother from Perth, who have claimed to cure themselves of cancer, or at least to have beaten cancer through natural therapies. And she had ovarian cancer, and her daughter, in fact, Laura, started a blog called Mum's Not Having Chemo, the title of which tells you everything about the stance that they were taking as a family. And this was a similar situation to Jess and Sharon Ainscough over in Queensland, in the sense that you had a mother and daughter. Well, in Jess and Sharon Ainscough's case, you had a mother and daughter who tragically both had cancer and both took the same non-treatment route. With Laura and Gemma Bond, you had the mother saying that she was going to do oxygen therapy. I think there may have been Gerson-type enemas involved. It was a whole lot of different alternative therapies. And the daughter writing a blog in which she chronicled her mother's apparent recovery from the illness.
I'm sorry, I shouldn't be laughing, but I suddenly remember a woman in Australia who claimed that she took no food at all, no nutrition whatsoever, and that this made her well. There is no limit to the gullibility of people, it would seem.
I believe you're talking about the breatharians there.
That's Philip. The ones.
Yeah. I once went to a breatharian conference and I saw that woman speaking to an audience of people and telling them with a straight face that food was completely unnecessary for their physical well-being, and that if they stopped eating food, they would feel much better. And there were a couple of people who did in fact starve themselves to death following this woman's advice.
Oh dear, oh dear. Can we protect people from their own stupidity?
Well, that
I mean, is there any legislative or proposition that could possibly save people who were that stupid?
I wonder, because there appears to be no law against offering people nonsensical advice about their health. I think if you're selling them a product, then clearly there is action that can be taken by the ACCC and various other bodies. There's an organisation that monitors registered health practitioners, but of course most of these people aren't registered health practitioners, and so they operate in a grey area. I do think, however, that there has, as a result of Jess Ainscoe's death and the exposure of Bell Gibson and various other related controversies, I do think that the authorities are taking a look at this, but I think they have a limited arsenal of measures.
Tell me this, what happens to followers, to believers, when their guru is either revealed as shonky or in fact dies? How do they cope with this?
In the case of Jess Ainscoe, there has been a rallying around her memory, and her family and her followers insist that her path that she took did not hasten her death, that conventional treatment had nothing to offer her, and there have been glowing tributes, including on the Gerson Institute website, to her. The case of Bell Gibson was such a flagrant exploitation, and that the response of her followers was one of absolute horror and revulsion. And I think that has actually flipped a switch in this movement. Talking to people in this movement, I sense that the Bell Gibson scandal has alerted them to the fact that some of the people who they thought were, that they idealised as being well-meaning warriors and angels, were in fact simply exploiting them.
Look, Richard, thank you very much. Richard Gilliatt, journalist with the Australian's Weekend magazine. And as he pointed out, we have a history that I had long since forgotten. Look, thanks to the team, who are all remarkable examples of wellness, intellectual wellness, that is, Matt O'Neill, Kate McDonald, Chris Short, and Ruth Slee, executive producer Gal Basario, and Michelle Watts. That was Late Night Live. Have a great weekend. Talk to you next week.